Larry is the general counsel of CBRE, which is a Fortune 500 company. And as general counsel, as you can imagine, he is the target of many cold emails sent by SDRs and AEs in an attempt to get his attention and get some time on the calendar. And he had an interesting take, because a lot of you listen to self-professed sales gurus like myself giving you advice and wisdom about how to get in front of people like Larry. But I thought it would be interesting to actually talk to Larry and get the perspective of the prospect in terms of the mistakes that reps are making when they reach out to him, and more importantly, what they could be doing to break through. So Larry, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to help.
So Larry, just for context for people listening, what does a general counsel do at a company? Broad brushstrokes.
Yeah, general counsel is the chief legal officer of the company. So it's really the person responsible for all legal affairs of the company. So if there's in-house lawyers at the company, they report in any litigation, transactions. We happen to be a public company, so public company filings with the SEC, all of those things that are legal in nature, ultimately I'm responsible for.
So if we take a look at the hierarchy of the org chart for people that are new to this, you'd be at the sort of top of the food chain with regards to a hierarchical org, right? You'd be like the decision maker, we call them in sales development or sales speak.
Sure. I report to the CEO of my company, and within the legal and compliance areas, I would be the most senior decision maker. That's not to say, Josh, that I make all of the decisions. In fact, one of the things we're going to talk about is how I actually empower my deputies and others in my organization to make the buying decisions on a lot of the things that I'm solicited for.
Yeah, we're going to get into that. But as the person that's at the top, I know sales development reps and AEs are always looking to email the people at the top, the CEO, the VP of sales, and in this case, the general counsel. And so Larry, as you can imagine, Larry, in a given week or month, how many solicitation emails would you say land in your inbox, not to mention the ones that never land in your inbox because they get screened out by IT?
Yeah, I actually think the ones that don't land in the inbox are way more numerous than the ones that do. And I would say there's probably five or six a day on a business day that come through the spam filters and end up in my email box. A lot of times I think it'll be more of the more established companies will somehow, I mean, you know, the filters assume that we're doing business with a lot of these companies. And so the emails come through. But yeah, I'd say probably five or six a day come through. And then if I were to look at my spam, you know, the spam that's been caught, I mean, there's hundreds of emails a day that I don't see.
And when you process an email, are you mostly processing it on your desktop, or are you mostly processing email on your phone, or is it a bit of combination of both?
Yeah, combination of both. And it really depends on where I'm sitting at the time. You know, if I'm working and I'm on my laptop, that's where I get my emails. And if I'm out for a nice stroll in the countryside and I'm on my phone, that's where I get the emails.
And if you had to say, take a guess, seconds-wise, how long does it take you to look at an email and decide if you're going to swipe right and delete it, or you're going to put it to the side and action it later, or you're going to respond? Like, how quickly does it take you to make that decision?
A nanosecond. It's really just a recognition. Do I recognize what's happening here or not? And, you know, do I recognize the sender? Do I recognize we'll get into it, but the catchphrase from someone I don't recognize is just as quickly swiped. What is it? Right is bad?
I think so. So let's get into this a little bit. Before we get into what to do right, I want to get into some patterns that you're seeing, some mistakes that you see reps make. Being the recipient of all these emails, I'm sure you're seeing some patterns emerging. And Larry's actually gone a step further. For those of you that are watching this podcast, we're actually going to talk about it first and give you a sense of what some of these mistakes are. And then we're going to actually delve in so you can actually see some of these emails. And again, our intent here isn't to bash sales professionals, because we are going to get into what people can be doing to be able to get someone like Larry's attention But we do want to spend some time knowing what the mistakes are and the cause of those mistakes. And I definitely have a perspective on that as well. And then we'll get into what you could do to get to someone like Larry. So if you're selling software to legal profession, the legal profession is a big, broad category. There's lots of nuances and lots of jobs that people have. And so finding out the right person with the right job is really critical. Getting to know exactly whose job you can help make better. And we're going to get into that a lot too, because just because someone's at the top of the food chain doesn't necessarily mean all lawyer inquiries go to that person, because it might have nothing to do with Larry's specific job. And we're going to get into all that on this podcast. So Larry, let's start off with, you know, some of the big mistakes that you see people making when you get these emails.
Yeah, I think they fall into a couple of different categories, Josh. I mean, the top of mind one is the kind of pretending familiarity, like as if we know each other and as if I've somehow made a decision to snub the person's last email or not take them up on lunch. And I'll show you an email just like that. But it's, I would say, someone who tries to get through defenses by kind of pretending we know each other, and then I realize later on that we don't. And that's worse, because then credibility is completely shot. And so that's the, you know, trying to be too familiar. And then the other one would be just kind of missing the industry altogether. Like, because I work at CBRE and it's a real estate company, I get solicited for software that assists, let's say, brokers in real estate, and I'm just not one. So someone bought a list with a bunch of CBRE emails on it, and I just, you know, and maybe it's a good strategy because there are some people in the list who are who it's applicable to, but it, you know, I'd swipe right on that one immediately. You know, the other ones, like, Josh, the product is something that I don't personally procure, but it's part of one of the functions within my department. I can't really blame the sales rep. I mean, if you could get to me, I could have a conversation with my person and say, hey, I'd like you to take a look at this. And I've done that many times when it's the right thing, right? So, but for the most part, a solicitation email, one of the easiest ways I could swipe right and have a clear conscience is to say, yeah, I'm sure this person's sending it to the right person. I'm just not the right person. So, you know, pass. So I don't know if you want to break that down. I could show you an example or two if you want.
Yeah, I got a couple follow-up questions for you. With regards to the sort of fake connection, are they using things like, you know, re-our conversation, like kind of shady stuff like that to make it look like you've had a conversation with that person? And do you even respond, or do you just delete it? Do you ever get angry?
I wouldn't say, you know, I'm sure in the past there've been folks who have actually, you know, been fraudulent and said, you know, oh, I met you somewhere or another, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm really more talking about some kind of familiarity based on a past interaction that just, like, for example, somebody who sent me three emails that I ignored will send a fourth one saying, you know, maybe my email was caught in your maybe my email didn't reach you, or maybe it was an inconvenient time or whatever. And maybe it's less about them faking familiarity and more about not getting the message that successive emails are not being responded to. And that gets me a little bit frustrated because, you know, Josh, if I were to call you three or four times and ask you to do something for me and I never got a call back, I don't think I would call again and say, maybe you are ignoring me, or maybe, you know, I know you're busy. So I don't know the answer. I don't know if the second attempt is good, and then the third one, you should just forget it and abandon. But that's, yeah, if I'm frustrated ever, it's where it's like, this person's just not getting the message.
Yeah. And so if we talk a little bit about the cause of this, so it's never been easier for salespeople to put emails on autopilot. So Larry, you might not be aware of this, but salespeople use technology to automatically drip these emails out without them having to do anything. So you can imagine email one goes out after one day, wait 5 days, send the follow-up, wait 5 days, send the follow-up, no reply, send the seventh one. And so people are really addicted to these tools. They're like addicted to speed. And it's really easy to dump in large amounts of data that people can find and dump in emails. And what ends up happening, and you're hearing Larry talk about this, is because you're going so fast, you're kind of burning out your addressable market because there's only so many times you can do that to people before they either blacklist you or they have a really bad taste in their mouth about you. The mere exposure effect can be positive and it can be negative. And so these touches that are irrelevant and following up consistently can annoy your market. You talk about 2 or 3% response rates, but you're not really thinking about the 97% of your total addressable market that you're sort of burning out. So the cause here is going too fast. And we're going to talk a little bit about the benefits of slowing down a little bit and really getting to understand Larry's job. And we're going to talk about this. Like, what is top of mind for Larry? Because Larry's like you. He's trying to level up. Larry doesn't want to stand still. He's always trying to be a better version of himself tomorrow. He's always open to new ideas that can help him do his job better. He might not be aware of everything that's out there. He might not know about problems that he might not know about that other lawyers know about that you can educate him. There's this whole world just like everybody else. But you kind of have to be a little bit deeper and understand that, which is we're going to get into that in the second half of the podcast. But before we do, Larry, let's actually see the hall of shame, so to speak.
The issue, Josh, is I haven't been able to obscure the name companies, but we'll fix it in post. And it really doesn't, matter. But so here's an email from someone at my ResMan or met at ResMan saying, I know it's been an adjustment for us. So there's some empathy around, I suppose, COVID and the pandemic. I have been trying to reach out to you. I have no idea if that's the case. To see if you'd be interested in taking a quick look at ResMan, our platform is helping property management companies build their virtual leasing offices. Well, I'm a lawyer, so this is immediately not applicable to me. I think I commend Grant for the hopefully things are settling in for you, but then remember I told you about feigning familiarity? I guess, how does he know that things are settling in for me? I've never met him.
Couple things too that jump out about this one. Larry probably doesn't want to have lunch with a salesperson, probably. Like that's kind of thing number one. And something else that's bopping out at me too is, companies are using us for virtual leasing offices. We talk a lot about this on the podcast. Nobody cares about what your product does. They care about what your product can do for them. And so this is what your product does, but it doesn't tell Larry what your product can do for him. And so that's another problem with this email.
That is right. There's no pain point. There's no pain point being addressed here. First of all, the email comes in, how about that lunch? And I would delete right there because how about that lunch is not the way, the people I actually do relate to in my job are like senior partners at law firms or at forensic firms, very, very senior people. And they wouldn't say, how about that lunch? And then it's, offer still stands. So there must have been a prior email that I missed. I'll send you a $50 e-card for a meal delivery for just taking a demo. So I don't know if it's lunch or now I'm taking a demo and now I'm being bribed to do it with a $50 e-card for a meal. If this is a good product, he should have said, general counsels like you are really struggling with, translation services are very expensive and we have a solution that can help you reduce your cost of translation by half. Now I'll read it. Then I'll read it.
Okay. I want you guys to really focus in on this because we're jumping ahead a little bit, but Larry just did something that, is part of the technique that I teach, which is using third-party credibility to be able to articulate how you can help someone be more awesome. So notice that Larry was not talking about the product. I don't even know what the product is. What Larry was talking about is what the product can do for Larry. In this case, if he's doing translation services, there's a mousetrap out there that can let him do it for less money. The other thing that kind of struck out at me is that he's actually referencing other lawyers like him. Larry is always, and so are all people, always going to be interested in what people like him are doing better. Social proof and third-party credibility is a really good way to do that, but you have to understand first, what exactly is the problem that Larry specifically has that he may or may not know about, and what can you help him potentially do better? So Larry, let's just talk a little bit about that since you brought it up. What are, like, I don't know if translation services is something that's top of mind for you, but I'm sure there's like a couple things that when you go to work every day are sore spots or things that are that you wish were a little bit easier or things that take a lot of time, and you've just accepted it because this is how you get the job done. And the analogy I always use is someone's in the kitchen making French fries with a knife. That's how they've been taught. Takes them 2 hours, takes them 45 minutes to clean up the kitchen, but that's just how they've always made the fries. And they just accept it because that's how they get the job done. You might not know about the Potato Peeler 3000. Larry, what are a couple of those things that you're doing every day that you just wish was a little bit easier, a little bit more simple?
Yeah. Well, look, in what I do when it comes to process, so I mentioned translation services. So if we have to put a policy out to 90 countries or whatever, you know, these things have to be translated, and sometimes the cost is high. So that was just top of mind. Legal technology is a huge industry, and it's getting a huge amount of venture capital. And so there's almost an unlimited number of tools and software. But I mean, matter management, our litigation portfolio has to be managed in a database. And, you know, we implemented a software that allows our outside law firms to communicate with us and invoice us and for us to approve invoices and take exceptions to invoices. I mean, that's been a key piece of technology that our department runs on and has for, you know, a long period of time. And everybody uses one of three companies in that space.
You bring up a great point here. This is a great point. Just because your product has a value proposition and just because it solves a problem doesn't necessarily mean that Larry's not solving it already today. So Larry's not sitting around not doing anything. He's making the fries the best way that he knows how with this software. So unless you know how he's getting the job done today, you don't have a what I call without statement. Like, what are you helping him do, but without doing this other thing that you're already doing that sucks? Because if you're pitching yet another one of these softwares that allows him to do a better work process, he's going to look at that email and say, oh, I got that covered already. We already have invoices that can be sent around and do all these things. This is the key thing about, you have to kind of understand Larry's world. You got to know how he's getting the job today and specifically what sucks about it. Like, Larry, is there anything that really sucks? And I'm using that word on purpose because problems have to be big and intense to get attention. I mean, I have a pixel out on the TV in my back bedroom, but I rarely watch that TV. I barely notice the pixel. It's a problem, but given everything else I have to do, it's not going to get my attention because I have limited resources.
No, look, there's things that sucks in every job. And, at my level in what I do, there's a huge amount of cost budget pressure. And so we look across all of our vendors and all of our processes. But for me, it comes down to really the staff, because it's very people intense, and then the outside law firms and other service providers. So a couple of years ago, the whole e-discovery. So when you are sued as a company or when you have an investigation, how do you analyze through millions of emails and documents that are on the company's system? That used to be incredibly expensive and manual. And now companies are bringing AI and other technological advancements to the sorting and filtering and reading of millions of documents to get down to a legally defensible group of documents that you can act on. That has been a huge push in legal circles, and it was a major pain point. I mean, you could spend millions of dollars on e-discovery, and AI is starting to really bat that cost, you know, way back down to earth.
If we talked about that and we did a little research on Larry, we could find pretty easily on the internet that Larry is a musician. Or we could find pretty easily that he's got some stuff on Spotify, which is like 3 or 4 minutes of research, because I did this before the call, right? So if you started, and knowing that problem, of e-discovery is labor intensive, extremely labor intensive. Knowing that that might be a pain point because he's getting it done, but it's extremely labor intensive, it's expensive, it's cumbersome. And are there other risks, Larry? Like when that work is done in a manual way, is it possible that you miss something?
No, sure. That you can be disqualified in a case if you withhold relevant discovery. I mean, there's big risk in that area of e-discovery. I mean, I am talking about last year's problem, right? I mean, this is a problem that has been in the last decade and chopped away. But I mean, I guess if you want to sell me an e-discovery system, maybe you could write a song about it. But
I want to go through this exercise. And then this is, Larry, you're solving this problem today, but I want to get people to think about how this process would go. So you could say something to Larry like this, you know, Larry, as a amateur musician on Spotify, singing songs about reverse Superman, sometimes it's very difficult to apply that same fluidity of music to your e-discovery process. What are you doing to ensure that your e-discovery doesn't get botched or that you don't miss things due to manual processes? For law firms like X, Y, and Z are using us to mitigate against these risks, interested in learning more. Like that, those aren't the exact right words, but that kind of a email, am I on track there?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, look, I the music thing is a hobby and a sidelight, but it's also passion. And it would be interesting if someone took the time to actually profile who they're sending emails to. I suspect, Josh, that these emails are being blasted to hundreds, if not thousands of people. So if someone gets a 1% or 2% response rate, they've kind of feel like they've done their job. So everything we're talking about doesn't matter, but in the legitimate companies who actually want to be our e-discovery vendor, who have senior salespeople, they're probably getting to me a different way, right? And they're probably either getting to me through a credible, what would you call it, a known associate, or some substance. And it's not just a blast email.
Yeah, let's talk about this because as I mentioned, a lot of times, and you guys have seen this, if you've been following me a while, sending cold emails is the hard way. The easier way is to actually get somebody that you know, that Larry knows, to write the email on your behalf and send it to Larry. So Larry mentioned this at the top of the podcast, which is the first thing he looks at is who's this from? Like, who's this email from? And if he doesn't recognize the email, he's going to automatically pretty much DQ it.
So an old general counsel friend of mine, okay? He is the general counsel at KB Home, Brian, who I really like. And I haven't talked to him in a decade, right? So all of a sudden I get long time no talk. I've been thinking about, you know, old sports club on Sepulveda. That's where I used to see him. Crazy times. He now read that my company's moving to Texas, blah, blah, blah. And then he goes, a fellow who has done some excellent legal research for me and who is based in Dallas, by the way, relevant because that's where we're moving, asked if I can make an introduction. His name is Russell Newhouse. In case you're looking to hire in Texas, I could highly recommend him. So if Brian Warham highly recommends someone, I'm going to take a phone call, right? Now, where I think he goes a little bit off track is he should have ended right there. Could I give Russell your contacts? Would you mind? Right? Instead, he actually copied and pasted this thing showing that this guy wants an introduction to me. He's taken me a little bit behind the scenes, right? So now I know Brian's heart isn't in it as much as I thought maybe he was in it, and he's just doing someone a favor. But he did a thoughtful job because, you know, he's also a very sophisticated senior general counsel and, you know, someone I like, someone I've known. But I think my response to Brian was, hey, really long time no speak. What a coincidence that we're speaking now. But I said, look, for you, I'll take a phone call from Russell. And that, now Russell can talk to me. I would never take an email from Russell without that, right?
So we talk a lot about this in the approach, which is this is the easiest, fastest path to someone's inbox and their calendar. And this is a lot easier than you think it is. And just to give you a little idea of how to do it, reach out to a customer that's maybe a general counsel, and your email can sound something like this. Doesn't have to be very fancy. Hey, Ben, this is probably going to be a huge imposition, but do you know any other legal counsels in your network that you think might be able to benefit from X? If not, no worries. But if so, happy to send you some text you can copy and paste to make it easier, Bob. Now, if you just did that to 5 people a day, I'm sure that one of them a week or every couple of weeks would say, you know what, I do know somebody and I will shoot off that email. And then to Larry's point, because he knows the person in the two line, he's going to open it up and give that person a shot. And so I know everyone's so interested in cold emailing, but it's the hardest path. I mean, even if you write a really good email, you still have to get over the barrier of you being a stranger. And if I'm hearing Larry right, that's a tough, tough, tough battle. Larry, have you ever taken an email? Have you ever read an email or responded positively to an email that has been like completely cold? Like you didn't have that connection. Nobody sent it. I mean, I would imagine the answer is no.
Well, when I first started in the job, and I've been in for 16 years, when I first started in the job, there was so much less that I knew, and I might have been pulled by a cold email that, you know, kind of hit on a point. And I've forwarded cold emails that looked like, you know, I have paid attention and it looked like something that might be interesting to someone. And I forwarded and said, hey, you might want to evaluate this. So I can't say that it can never work, but I would say, look, in the last decade, it would be really, really tough to get through. I mean, I wish I could name an example, but I would tell you there's examples of like lifelong friendships that started with a complete cold introduction, right? I mean, these things do happen.
When you say cold introduction, meaning what you just shared an example of before, like somebody introduced you to somebody and then you had a relationship with that person based on the introduction, or completely cold?
Yeah, well, that for sure. Like one of my closest friends here in LA is someone who was introduced to me in a kind of a vendor situation. He was an outside lawyer, and I agreed to meet, and we hit it off on such a personal level that we became friends outside of work and are still friends. What I'm saying is it can happen where a guy like Russell, who I'll take his call, Russell, if you're out there, call me. A guy like Russell, who knows, you know, he could end up being a key, you know, person for our company just because of that. But, you know, your question was more like, hey, that guy Grant who said, how about that lunch? I mean, the odds of that are, and here's another one, just a throwaway for you. It's when the junior salesperson is doing canvassing for someone who actually runs a company, it's even worse, right? And it's even worse by phone. Like I'll somehow pick up the phone and get a call, and it's someone who's like barely articulate, reading a script, trying to get a meeting for someone else. It's even worse than an email, because now I've literally taken time out of my day, having to, you know, pay attention to someone who I thought was someone else or whatever when they called.
Now, Larry, you're the kind of guy who, and I've known you for quite some time, you're the kind of guy that is always looking to level up and improve and get better. I mean, you know how you have a passion for music, and every time I talk to you, you're tinkering with some new kind of software, or you're hiring some people to sing some stuff, or you're trying to level up your music. And I would imagine in your professional career, you're doing the same. What types of things do you look for that start to spark you to look? Like what kind of situations happen at work that cause you to think, gee, what we're using isn't quite working right now? Something's got to change. Maybe this happens over the course of time. Maybe you're like, oh, that was a glitch. We're just going to stick with what we have. But then maybe it happens again and it's more intense. You're like, there's like this first thought, and then there's a second thought, and then maybe you sick your people on, not sick your people, but you task people to go look for stuff. Like, talk to me a little bit about that buyer's journey and when that sort of unfolds, what the cause happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a couple different reasons that would happen. I mean, one would be a, kind of a negative experience that you might have with an incumbent. One might be a closer look at budget. And we're all going through it now with, especially this year, where it's like you try to make ends meet on your budget and you realize with this particular vendor, it's just never going to happen. So you look at alternatives. You know, really where it could happen is what we've been talking about, which is somebody taps you on the shoulder through one of your professional networks and says, there's a better mousetrap out here. And, you know, when you mentioned the music thing, and, you know, I've told you this, like I go on, you know, YouTube, and I'm trying to learn, how to do production better. And, a lot of times it's the expertise or the learning that actually hooks me. When it comes to the music stuff, I've bought software after I've done someone's, seminar. There's a company called waves.com, Waves, that sells software for music production. And the way they hook you is they have these leading light producers do these 10-minute videos showing you how to, and it's a pain point. It's like how to get more pop in your drums, you know, or how to get a better, how to mix with better depth, you know? And so you're like, oh, I want to mix with better depth. So you go in there and it's someone who's mixed for Beyonce or, you know, Pharrell or whatever. And so you're like, oh, I'll watch that. And because they have that credibility. And then you go in and it's really kind of, they're using this company's products, product placement. And then you're like, well, I've got to get that. So I, you know, I could actually on the music side can speak to current, like I've opened my wallet based on these YouTube videos several times.
Yes, let's talk about this because most of the time when you reach out to someone, if you're doing cold outreach, they're not in buy mode, but they are in learn mode. So what Larry's talking about here is companies making deposits, right? They're providing him with something of educational value that can make him smarter about a topic that he's interested in. And because they're making deposits and they're teaching him something, you develop an affinity for the teacher. So if you're a salesperson, think of yourself as a teacher, not a student. What might you be able to teach Larry, maybe not about music, but maybe about something that he's interested in with regards to the legal profession? I mean, imagine if he got a one-sentence email that said, hey, Larry, here's a three-minute seminar on X, and X being some topic. Like, let's actually play this out a little bit because I'm curious about it. What would be, I'm sure you have professional development things at work that you do that to stay current, like any job. You don't just rest on your laurels. There's always stuff you got to learn. And what types of education or professional topics are you interested in that you read about? Maybe you attend webinars. Maybe you read trade journals. What are some of those areas?
Yeah. Well, you know, we talked about legal technology. And what would be really cool is kind of a shortcut way to navigate. So there are these big conferences and they used to be, you know, in convention centers and now they're, I guess, virtual, but you'd walk up and down, and every industry has this. You walk up and down the aisles and you try to avoid the making eye contact because then you get pulled into the booth.
You don't want the free Kush ball? That's not enough to pull you in?
Yeah. If you want the Kush ball, it's like a timeshare. If you want the free massage, you got to go look at the timeshare. But, so there needs to be a way that somebody can curate that experience for me in 5 minutes and say, here's five things that will blow your mind that are happening right now that 5 years from now will be table stakes and you can get there first. Like that would be really cool.
So that's a one sentence email. Literally, it's a one sentence email to Larry. Imagine if you sent 4 or 5 of those deposits over the course of several months. Eventually, Larry might look at the footer of that email and say, well, who is this person that's been sending me all this cool stuff about how to level up my music? And in this case, my lawyer legal skills. He might look at that footer without you having to even do anything. And then when you call him or email him after it's been 4 months or 3 months, he might be more open to hearing what it is that you have to say, because before you've made your withdrawal, you've made a series of deposits. I mean, in the sales profession, that's what I do on LinkedIn. Every day I'm writing about topics, how to cold email, how to make cold calls, how to diffuse objections. Those are all deposits. Some people read those, head over to my web page and buy stuff over the course of like many months. They don't just buy it the first time they're exposed to me. So I love this strategy for someone like Larry. Find out what are the things that Larry cares about in terms of topics. He just gave you one. I would imagine if you Googled legal counsels, you can see what kind of webinars they're attending, see what kind of things they're reading about, and can you develop, collaborating with your marketing department, these one sentence emails. Larry, here's this, here's this, here's a 2 minute thing on this, here's a way to stay ahead of the curve on X. Just like a sentence.
Yeah. I mean, we spend as a company millions of dollars on outside law firms to do various types of work. And from time to time, there's been gurus who have said, you know, we could show you how you can get 20, 25% more efficiency and savings on your outside counsel spend. And I say, that's millions of dollars, right? That we can show you how is the deposit, right? We can show you how. And then if they can really show me how, and it happens to be a technology or a consultant or whatever, they can then make the withdrawal, or I'd buy what they're selling. That's the almost the guaranteed savings type thing, which is I'll show you how. It's like what you would do. I'll show you how to make your effectiveness, go up by 50%. How much is that worth? Like if you spend $10 million a year on these vendors and I could get you 10%, that's $1 million. Would my software be worth $50,000?
Yeah. And the way I might phrase that in an email, and if you've been listening to this podcast a while, you know, these illumination questions I love in emails, you know, Larry, how do you know you're not overpaying for outside legal services? X company was able to use a new approach to reduce these fees by 30%. Interested in hearing more. Like that's at least something that's two sentences that's focused on again, big expense. You heard Larry say this. I want to be really careful that people understand this. He said there were millions of dollars. He didn't say $5, $100, or $10,000. Those are like not problems that are big enough to get his attention because of the risk of switching. I got to go spin up contracts. Is it going to work? Am I going to lose my job? But when you have something that's big and expensive, and if you have a better mousetrap, that kind of a sentence is going to get his attention, especially if you couple it with a warm introduction from someone that he knows.
I've saved 20%. I saved Pfizer 15% on their $3 billion legal spend, right? I like something like that, because then that's, you know, a reference to a credible source or reference. It's something that would grab my attention because, like I said, budgets are a huge concern. And that's my, other than my salaries, you know, other than people, that's my biggest spend. And if you can make a dent in that for me, that would be awesome.
And I want to summarize this again, because it's so important. It's literally a three sentence email. Larry, what are you doing to ensure you're not overpaying for outsourced legal fees? Pfizer's using us and just saved $3 million last quarter. Interested in learning how they're doing it.
We'll show you how they do it or whatever. And that email would hook me.
Why?
Because it's a top of mind problem that I've got to solve and I haven't yet solved. It's referencing, I just picked Pfizer because of this whole vaccine thing, but it's referencing one of the great companies of the world who I think is, and here's a finer point, they're better than we are or bigger than we are at this thing. So it's not, if you try to use a reference of someone who you come into CBRE and say, Cushman & Wakefield is doing this. I mean, they're a good company, but you know, we're a much larger company than they are, right? So the point would be, you know, General Electric or, you know, Amazon is doing this. Now I'm looking at how do I become, what did you call it, leveling up? I want to be leveling up, not looking at what companies who are 5-10 years behind us have done.
So again, this is playing into herd mentality. This is playing into social proof, but I also want to go the other way because I have a client that has Walmart, but they're using Walmart in every email. Well, guess what? It works the other way too. If you're small and you don't associate yourself with Walmart, that email is not going to resonate. So it's not just any company, to Larry's point, it's companies that are similar to Larry's company that he aspires to be. Larry, as a musician, he aspires. So Larry, as a musician, if he wants to level up, does not want to talk to me because Larry's a 7, I'm a 3. Larry does want to talk to a 9 or a 10. And again, this doesn't have to be complicated, but it does take a little research to say, who might Larry want to look up to? Gee, we have this marquee client. It's Amazon. It's Pfizer. We've saved them X in outsourced legal fees with our better mousetrap. Maybe, you know, at last sentence could be, Larry, thought you'd be interested too. Like, you don't have to ask him for 45 minutes of his time, because if Larry's interested, he'll lean forward. I want to talk about that as well, Larry. And I know we missed it a little bit before, but one of my pet peeves in an email is when reps ask people like you for 45 minutes of their time in an email. Now, just to keep this into consideration, this time is Larry's most valuable, most precious asset that he has. 45 minutes is a big ask for someone at Larry's level. Do you see this happening a lot, Larry? People like asking for your time.
Yeah, it just happened just now. It just happened with you. No, I mean, look, and by the way, you're in business. This podcast is great, by the way, but I mean, I'm giving you this time because of our relationship, right? I don't, you know, if I didn't know you, I wouldn't do a podcast on how to sell better, right? So, but I do think your point is really well taken on the, what would you call the luminary?
Illumination questions get people to think differently about how they're getting the job done today, but they're not leading. It's not like, if I could save you $50, would you be interested? It's like, what are you doing to ensure? How would you know it's time to take a look at your spend for outside legal counsel? We just saved Pfizer 32% in their outsourced legal fees. Want to learn how they're doing it? Like, that's the email. And it's not, we do this. Notice it's focused on what it is that allows you to do something better, not what your product does, what it does for you. And so many of the emails that you shared were, Redman is a leasing automation platform. That doesn't help you kick more ass.
Right. The point I was making was a little bit different, which is, when I go on the music websites, I'm impressed by, you know, the person who's teaching the seminar because they did the last album for whatever, Coldplay, right? And when I'm in the legal mode, I'm impressed by Brian, who's the general counsel of KB Homes, right? A big company in my industry, or, you know, talk about Amazon or Pfizer, one of those companies. So I think there's something to, we all want to learn from someone who is at the top of their profession. And so that's, you know, small company might say Walmart, we have nothing to do with them. Company like mine, really 2 points. I just hired one of the top litigators from Walmart, and he was a great candidate to run our litigation, but he was also ran it at Walmart. It's a big deal, right? Having done it for someone not smaller than us, but bigger and more sophisticated than us. The other point is, there's a big professional services firm that has a longstanding relationship with me, and they called me and said, what could we do better to have a more strategic business relationship with you? What is it that you could use? And by the way, what is it that your people could use from us that you're not getting? And I said, each of us needs to have the single most, experienced, leading light in their profession. So, you know, leading light, like this, this professional services firm is a huge firm, and the leaders of their practice areas, like internal audit or e-discovery, all of the things that, you know, anti-corruption, all the things that they want to sell into us, they have someone in their firm who, you know, served in the Obama administration as the head of cyber this, or who, you know, ran something else, but they have someone who, you know, is a leading light in their profession. And that's who we want to learn from.
You make a great point here, because, you know, the reason people are so guarded around salespeople is because salespeople are biased, right? They know that salespeople have commission breath, that they're putting their best interests first. And so when you lead with, as Larry calls it, a guiding light, what it does is it starts to establish credibility. You know, who is this person like me that's better than me, that's doing this thing that I desire? That's going to hook someone, because humans are wired for self-betterment. Everybody wants to be a better version of themselves tomorrow than they are today, but it's going to require you to do a little homework. And now if you sell into this, Larry, please don't email him 50 times tomorrow. Please don't send him this email we just talked about. Larry, you have said it all, my friend. You have been so generous with your time, and hopefully you won't get barraged by 50,000 emails saying, hey, Larry, heard you on the Inside Selling podcast. What you said to Josh about blah, 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 because, you know, I'm going to never hear the end of it. Every time we get together, you're going to be saying, Josh, I get 50 emails a day. Look at all these.
Well, I'm glad to help. And it's really kind of, it helps me, right? I'm helping you help me so that I don't get the bad emails and that I do get to solve business problems better, because the sales force is out there being thoughtful about how to approach it.
You know, I think that's a great way to end this, because Larry is not saying he doesn't like salespeople.
Not at all.
And that these cold outreaches are bad. What we're doing here is Larry's bought a lot of products from salespeople. He's just trying to help salespeople be a little bit better, to give you a better shot at helping him. So hopefully this was done in the spirit of that. Larry, I just want to do a quick 4-minute thing at the end here, because it was so interesting. When we got together, you had developed a newsletter. Talk about making deposits around ethics. And in that newsletter, you kind of made a couple points about, like, it was like how to be, you know, do what you
say. Sure. Trust.
I want to talk a little about the sort of guiding posts of this newsletter, and then specifically how this relates to sales. So Larry, can you talk a little bit about the newsletter,
sure,
just briefly, and then these kind of guiding tenets?
Sure. So 10 years ago or more, I started in my capacity in my company as the person who promulgates policies and, you know, standards for our ethics and values and even policies around compliance. I figured out that nobody wanted to read this stuff. And so I also figured out that a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, as you know, famously said. So I started kind of wrapping these announcements in some things that I thought would be kind of fun to read. And over time, through the feedback that I got, it's now become the most read email of my company, like bar none. You know, we've got 100,000 people. I think 70,000 people open this thing and read it actually every month. And the reason for that is that it takes a very kind of folksy, authentic, real, like, I write it not the way corporate communications departments or, frankly, salespeople write their emails. I write it the way I'm talking right now. And I pepper it with some pop culture references and pictures and kind of catchphrases and things like that. And you know, so I'll sell, you know, a message. Let's say we're doing anti-harassment. I might write an article about, you know, the mayor of Toronto or Justin Bieber or, you know, some pop song that's out and use the lyrics. But so it's fun. And the last one, the one you're referring to, I showed you, Josh, was about how do we build trust? We're a big company, and why should you trust us to bring forward your concerns and your, you know, even reports of misconduct? Why would you trust that we would do the right thing by you? And I think what you're referring to is, I boiled it down, I'm like, Larry's rules of, it's like Midler's rules of trust. Just like the last one, I said Midler's rules of email. But Midler's rule of trust, it's like, say what you're gonna do, do it, and if you don't do it, take responsibility and say how you're gonna fix it. And, you know, when it's put that way, people remember it. Like my email one, I said, and we're talking about corporate email etiquette, we're not talking about sales, but I said, don't put stupid stuff in your emails. Everyone can remember that. Just, if you're thinking of putting something in your email that shouldn't be in there, stop. And the other one is, you know, if don't click, you know, loose clicks sink ships or something like that. It's like, don't click on links in your email because it's probably just, you know, kind of cyber hackers or whatever. So it's those kind of things. And we've done it for 140 issues on a monthly basis. So that'll tell you that it goes back, you know, about 11, 12 years now. And it's, we built a brand around it within our company, and people look forward to it coming out. So
a couple things. One, I get a lot of emails every day from people saying, I could never be informal with a lawyer. I could never write this way to a CEO. I could never write this way to a VP of whatever. And what we're hearing Larry saying is, Larry's just a person who watches TV. And I think he does appreciate, if it's done in a clever way, language in sales emails that's not so formal and stiff. If you're able to be clever and tie in his reverse Superman song in a clever way that you could also help him be more awesome, and make him smile a little bit, you're going to increase your chances of being able to start a conversation with him. And I do want to end on having him repeat those three things again, because when I heard them at breakfast, I thought, man, what a way to just focus on your sales philosophy. Because one of the biggest problems salespeople have because of what we do is trust. And in order to have trust, you got to have credibility, and you got to follow through on what it is you say you're going to do. So Larry, to end this podcast, can you just repeat that mantra one more time?
Yeah. Say, tell me what you're going to do. Do it. If you don't do it, take responsibility and, you know, tell me how it's going to be different next time.
And the key word there being take responsibility, not blaming. Not blaming your manager, not blaming your small territory. I love that, Larry. Larry, thank you so much for dropping so many knowledge bombs.
Oh, you're welcome, and good luck with everything. Talk to you soon.